I'm sorry, considered a term of a hand over his face. He gave a little laugh. To undo the Phillips head screws in order to remove the back panel from the remote control. Then it was all a blur. Douglas saw nothing, and then Sherman was replacing the panel. "There you go," Sherman said, and gave the car and controller back to Loomis. Loomis Rump laughed. "You didn't even do nothing," he said. "Anything," Sherman corrected him. Loomis put the car on the floor and switched on the remote. The car rolled away, nearly tripping a postal worker, and crashed to a stop at the door. It capsized, but its wheels kept spinning. "Hey, hey," the skinny boy shouted. "Hey, thanks, mister," Loomis said, and the boys left. Fat Loomis Rump and his skinny pals told their friends, and they brought in their broken toys. Sherman fixed them. The fat boy's friends told their parents, and Douglas found his shop increasingly crowded with customers and their small appliances. "The Rump boy told me that you fixed his toy car, and the Johnson woman told me that you repaired her radio," the short man who wore the waterworks uniform said. Sherman was wiping down the counter. "Is that true?" Sherman nodded. "Well, you see these cuts on my face?" Douglas could see the cuts under the man's 3-day growth of stubble from the door to the kitchen. Sherman leaned forward and studied the wounds. "They seem to be healing nicely," Sherman said. "It's this damn razor," the man said, and he pulled the small unit from his trousers pocket. "It cuts me bad every time I try to shave."
"And you'd like me to fix your razor?"
"If you wouldn't mind, but I don't have any money."
"That's okay."
Sherman took the razor and began taking it apart. Douglas, as always, moved closer and tried to see. He smiled at the waterworks man, who smiled back. Other people gathered around and watched Sherman's hands. Then they watched him hand the reassembled little machine back to the waterworks man. The man turned on the shaver and put it to his face.
"Hey," he said, "this is wonderful. It works just like it did when it was new. This is wonderful. Thank you. Can I bring you some money tomorrow?"
"Not necessary," Sherman said.
"This is wonderful."
Everyone in the restaurant oohed and awed.
"Look," the waterworks man said, "I'm not bleeding."
Sherman sat quietly at the end of the counter and fixed whatever was put in front of him. He repaired hair dryers and calculators and watches and cell phones and carburetors. And while people waited for the repairs, they ate sandwiches, and this appealed to Sherman, though he didn't like his handyman's time so consumed. But the fact of the matter was that there was little more to fix in the shop. One day, a woman who believed her husband was having an affair came in and complained over a turkey and provolone on wheat. Sherman sat next to her at the counter and listened as she finished.
"And then he comes home hours after he's gotten off from work, smelling of beer and perfume, and he doesn't want to talk or anything, and says he has a sinus headache, and I'm wondering if I ought to follow him or check the mileage on his car before he leaves in the morning. What should I do?"
"Tell him it's his turn to cook and that you'll be late, and don't tell him where you're going," Sherman said.
Everyone in the shop nodded, more in shared confusion than agreement.
"Well, where should I go?"
the woman asked.
"Go to the library and read about the praying mantis," Sherman said.
Douglas came up to Sherman after the woman had left and asked, "Do you think that was a good idea?" Sherman shrugged. The woman came in the next week, her face full with a smile, and announced that her home life was near perfect.
"Everything at home is perfect now," she said, "thanks to Sherman."
Customers slapped Sherman on the back. So began a new dimension of fixing in the shop as people came in along with their electric pencil sharpeners, pacemakers, and microwaves, their relationship woes, and their tax problems. Sherman saved the man who owned the automotive supply business across the street $12,000 and got him some $57 in refund. One night after the shop was closed, Douglas and Sherman sat at the counter and ate the stale leftover donuts and drank coffee. Douglas looked at his handyman and shook his head.
"That was really something, the way you straightened the Reinhardt boy's teeth."
"Physics,"
Sherman said. Douglas washed down a dry bite and set his cup on the counter.
"I know I asked you before, but we've known each other longer now. How did you learn to fix things?"
"Fixing things is easy. You just have to know how things work."
"And that's it," Douglas said, more than asked. Sherman nodded.
Well, doesn't it make you happy to do it? Sherman looked at Douglas, questioning. I mean, because you never smile. Oh, Sherman said and took another bite of donut. The next day, Sherman fixed a chainsaw and a laptop computer and 32 parking tickets. Sherman, who had always been quiet, became increasingly more so. He would listen, nod, and fix the problem. That evening, a few minutes before closing, just after Sherman had solved the Murata woman's sexual identity problem, two paramedics came in with a patient on a stretcher. This is my wife, the more distressed of the ambulance men said of the supine woman. She'd been hit by a car and died in our rig on the way to the hospital, he cried. Sherman looked at the woman, pulling back the blanket. She had massive internal... Sherman stopped the man with a raised hand, pulled the blanket off, and threw it over himself and the dead woman. Douglas stepped over to stand with the paramedics. Sherman worked under the blanket, moving this way and that way, and then he and the woman emerged, alive and well. The paramedic hugged her. You're alive, the man said to his wife. The other paramedic shook Sherman's hand. Douglas just stared at his handyman. Thank you, the husband said, crying. The woman was confused, but she too offered Sherman thanks. Sherman nodded and walked quietly away, disappearing into the kitchen. The paramedics and the restored woman left. Douglas locked the shop and walked into the kitchen where he found Sherman sitting on the floor with his back against the refrigerator. I don't know what to say, Douglas said. His head was swimming. You just brought that woman back to life. Sherman's face looked lifeless. He seemed drained of all energy. He lifted his sad face up to look at Douglas. How did you do that? Douglas asked. Sherman shrugged. You just brought a woman back to life and you give me a shrug? Douglas could hear the fear in his voice. Who are you? What are you? Are you from outer space or something? No, Sherman said. Then what's going on? I can fix things. That wasn't a thing, Douglas pointed out. That was a human being. Yeah, I know. Douglas ran a hand over his face and just stared down at Sherman. I wonder what Sheila will say. Please, don't tell anyone about this, Sherman said. Douglas snorted out a laugh. Don't tell anyone. I don't have to tell anyone. Everyone probably knows by now. What do you think those paramedics are out doing right now? They're telling anybody and everybody that there's some freak in Langley's sandwich shop who can revive the dead. Sherman held his face in his hands. Who are you? News spread. Television news trucks and teams camped outside the front door of the sandwich shop. They were waiting with cameras ready when Douglas showed up to open for business the day following the resurrection. Yeah, this is my shop, he said. No, I don't know how it was done, he said. No, you can't come in just yet, he said. Sherman was sitting at the counter waiting, his face long, his eyes red, as if from crying. This is crazy, Douglas said. Sherman nodded. They want to talk to you. Douglas looked closely at Sherman. Are you all right? But Sherman was looking past Douglas and through the front window where the crowd was growing ever larger. Are you going to talk to him? Douglas asked. Sherman shook his sad face. I have to run away, he said. Everyone knows where I am now. Douglas at first thought Sherman was making cryptic reference to the men who had been beating him that night long ago, but then realized that Sherman meant simply everyone. Sherman stood and walked into the back of the shop. Douglas followed him, not knowing why, unable to stop himself. He followed the man out of the store and down the alley, away from the shop and the horde of people. Sherman watched a change come over Douglas and said, Well, of course not. But you... The rest of Douglas's sentence didn't have a chance to find air as he was once again repeating Sherman's steps. They ran up this street and across that avenue, crossed bridges and scurried through tunnels, and no matter how far away from the shop they seemed to get, the chanting remained, however faint. Douglas finally asked where they were going and confessed that he was afraid. They were sitting on a bench in the park, and it was by now just after sundown. You don't have to come with me, Sherman said. I only need to get away from all of them. He shook his head and said more to himself, I knew this would happen. Well, if you knew this would happen, why'd you fix all those things? Because I can't. Because I was asked. Douglas gave nervous glances this way and that across the park. This has something to do with why those men were beating you that night, doesn't it? They were from the government or some businesses, I'm not completely sure, Sherman said. They wanted me to fix a bunch of things, and I said no. But they asked you, Douglas said. You just told me. You have to be careful about what you fix. If you fix the valves in an engine, but the bearings are shot, you'll get more compression, but the engine will still burn up. Sherman looked at Douglas's puzzled face. If you irrigate a desert, you could just empty a sea. It's a complicated business, fixing things. Douglas said, so what do we do now? Sherman was now weeping, tears streaming down his face and curving just under his chin before falling to the open collar of his light blue shirt. Douglas watched him, not believing that he was seeing the same man who had fixed so many machines and so many relationships and so many businesses and concerns and even fixed a dead woman. Sherman raised his tear-filled eyes to Douglas. I am the empty sea, he said. A chanting became louder, and Douglas turned to see the night dotted with yellow-orange torches. The quality of the chanting had become strained, and there was an urgency in the intonation that did not sound affable. The two men ran, Douglas pushing Sherman, as he was now so engaged in sobbing that he had trouble keeping on his feet. They made it to the big bridge that crossed the bay and stopped in the middle, discovering that at either end, thousands of people waited. They sang a dirge into the dark sky, flames winking. Fix us, they shouted. Fix us, fix us. Sherman looked down at the peaceful water below. It was a long drop that no one could hope to survive. He looked at Douglas. Douglas nodded. The masses of people pressed in from either side. Sherman stepped over the railing and stood on the brink. The toes of his shoes pushed well over the edge. Don't, they all screamed. Fix us! Fix us! That story was called The Fix by my old, schoolboy chum, college buddy, who I don't talk to anymore, not for any reason other than, you know, Percival Everett, from his collection of short stories, Damned If I Do, came out 2004 on Grey Wolf Press. Now I'm going to read a story by a writer I have never met, but have read probably since that time, who, like Percival has 20 novels out, but you probably never heard of him. I mean, I didn't even know that he had anything published until this guy I was working for told me, because I write, and Percival is also a Negro. And so he was like, did you ever read this Negro? Who went to Brown like you? I was like, but I didn't know him as Percival. I knew him as Percy. Anyway, so that this guy, well, I was reading around the same time, Clarence Major, he's older, like 20 years, almost 85, I think. They're both, anyways. His Clarence Major is famous to writers, but not the general public, just like Percy. This story is from a collection, recent collection of Clarence Major's work called The Essential Clarence Major, Prose and Poetry. And the tale is entitled My Mother and Mitch by Clarence Major. My Mother and Mitch. He was just somebody who had dialed the wrong number. This is how it started, and I wasn't concerned about it, not at first. I don't even remember if I was there when he first called, but I do, all these many years later, Remember my mother on the phone speaking to him in her best quiet voice, trying to sound as ladylike as she knew how. She had these different voices for talking to different people on different occasions. I could tell by my mother's proper voice that this man was somebody she wanted to make a good impression on, a man she thought she might like to know. This was back when my mother was still a young woman, divorced but still young enough to believe that she was not completely finished with men. She was a skeptic from the beginning, I knew that even then, but some part of her thought the right man might come along some day. I don't know exactly what it was about him that attracted her, though. People are too mysterious to know that well. I know that now, and I must have been smart enough not to wonder too hard about it back then. Since I remember hearing her tell him her name, she must not have given it out right off the bat when he first called. She was a city woman with a child, and had developed an alertness to danger. One thing you didn't do was to give your name to a stranger on the phone. You never knew who to trust in a city like Chicago. The place is full of crazy people, criminals. She said, "My name is Mrs. Jane Anderson." I can still hear her laying the emphasis on the Mrs., although she had been separated from my father 12 years when this man dialed her number by accident. Mitch Kibbs was the name he gave her. I guess he must have told her who he was the very first time, just after he apologized for calling her by mistake. I can't remember who he was trying to call. He must have told her, and she must have told me, but it's gone now. I think they must have talked a pretty good while that first time. The first thing that I remember about him was that he lived with his sister, who was older than he. The next thing was that he was very old. He must have been 50, and to me, at 15, that was deep into age. If my mother was old at 35, 50 was ancient. Then the other thing about him was that he was white. They'd talked 5 or 6 times, I think, before he came out and said he was white, but she knew it before he told her. I think he made this claim only after he started to suspect he might not be talking to another white person. But the thing was, he didn't know for sure she was black. I was at home, lying on the couch, pretending to read a magazine, when I heard her say, "I am a colored lady." Those were her words exactly. She placed the emphasis on lady. I had never known my mother to date any white men. She would hang up from talking with him, and she and I would sit at the kitchen table, and she would tell me what he had said. They were telling each other the bits and pieces of their lives, listening to each other, feeling their way as they talked. She spoke slowly, remembering all the details. I watched her scowl and the way her eyes narrowed as she puzzled over his confessions, as she told me, in her own words, about them. She was especially puzzled about his reaction to her confession about being colored. That night she looked across at me with that fearful look that was hers alone and said, "Tommy, I doubt if he will ever call back. Not after tonight. He didn't know that. You know that." Feeling grown up because she was treating me that way, I said, "Well, I wouldn't be so sure." And he called back soon after that. I was curious about her interest in this particular white man, so I always listened carefully. I was a little bit scared, too, because I suspected he might be some kind of maniac or pervert. I had no good reason to fear such a thing, except that I thought it strange that anybody could spend as much time as he and my mother did talking on the phone without any desire for human contact. She had never had a telephone relationship before, and at that time, all I knew about telephone relationships was that they were insane and conducted by people who probably needed to be put away. This meant that I also had the sad feeling that my mother was a bit crazy, too. But more important than these fearful fantasies, I thought I was witnessing a change in my mother. It seemed important, and I didn't want to misunderstand it or miss the point of it. I tried to look on the bright side, which was what my mother always said I should try to do. He certainly didn't sound dangerous. 2 or 3 times I myself answered the phone when he called, and he always said, "Hello, Tommy, this is Mitch. May I speak to your mother?" And I always said, "Sure, just a minute." He never asked me how I was doing or anything like that, and I never had anything special to say to him. After he had been calling for over a month, I sort of lost interest in hearing about their talk. But she went right on telling me what he said. I was a polite boy, so I listened, despite the fact that I had decided that Mitch Kibbs and his ancient sister, Temple Erickson, were crazy but harmless. My poor mother was lonely. That was all. I had it all figured out. He wasn't an axe murderer who was going to sneak up on her one evening when she was coming home from a job at the office and split her open from the top down. We were always hearing about things like this, so I knew it wasn't impossible. My interest would pick up occasionally. I was especially interested in what happened the first time my mother herself made the call to his house. She told me that Temple Erickson answered the phone. Mother and I were eating dinner when she started talking about Temple Erickson. She's a little off in the head, Mother said. I didn't say anything, but it confirmed my suspicion. What surprised me was my mother's ability to recognize it. What would she say? She rattled on about the Wild West, said Mother, and about the Indians and having to hide in a barrel or something like that. She said Indians were shooting arrows at them, and she was just a little girl who hid in a barrel. I thought about this. Well, maybe she lived out west when she was little, you know? She must be 100 by now. That would make her the right age. Oh, come now, Tommy, Mother laughed. What she said was she married when she was 14, married this Erickson fellow. As near as I could figure out, he must have been a leather tanner. But it seems he also hunted. Well, none of that sounds crazy. I was disappointed. She was talking crazy, though. Well, how so? Well, she thinks the Indians are coming back to attack the house any day now. She says things like Erickson was still living, like he was just off there in the next room, taking a nap. One of the first things Mitch told me was that his sister and he moved in together after her husband died, and that was 20 years ago. How did the husband die? She finished chewing her peas first. He was kicked in the head by a horse, bled to death. I burst out laughing because the image was so bright in my mind and I couldn't help myself. My pretty mother had a sense of humor even when she didn't mean to show it. She chewed her peas in a ladylike manner. This was long before she lost her teeth. Sitting there across the table from her, I knew I loved her and needed her, and I knew she loved and needed me. I did not yet fear that she needed me too much. She had a lot of anger in her, too. Men had hurt her bad. And one day, I was going to be a man. When I laughed, my mother said, "You shouldn't laugh at misfortune, Tommy." But she had this silly grin on her face, and it caused me to laugh again. I think now I must have been a bit hysterical from the anxiety I'd been living with all those weeks while she was telling me about the telephone conversations that I wanted to hear about only part of the time. It was dark outside, and I got up when I finished my dinner and went to the window and looked down at the streetlights glowing in the wet pavement. I said, "I bet he's out there right now, hiding in the shadows, watching our window." "Who?" Her eyes grew large. She was easily frightened. I knew this, and I was being devilish and deliberately trying to scare her. "You know, Mr. Kibbs." She looked relieved. "No, he's not. He's not like that. He's a little strange, but not a pervert." "How do you know?" By the look she gave me, I knew now that I had thrown doubt into her, and she wasn't handling it well. She didn't try to answer me. She finished her small, dry pork chop and ate the last of her bright green peas and reached over and took up my plate and sat it onto her own. She took the dishes to the sink and turned on the hot and cold water so that warm water gushed out of the single faucet, causing the pipe to clang, and she started washing dishes. "You have a vivid imagination," was all she said. I grabbed the dishcloth and started drying the first plate she placed in the rack to drain. "Even so, you don't know this man. You've never even seen him. Aren't you curious about what he looks like?" "I know what he looks like." "Well, how?" "He sent me a picture of himself in one of Temple." I gave her a look. She'd been holding out on me. I knew he was crazy now. Was he so ugly she hadn't wanted me to see the picture? "Well, can I see the pictures?" "Sure." She dried her hands on the cloth I was holding and then took her cigarettes out of her dress pocket and knocked one from the pack and stuck it between her thin lips. I watched her light it and fan the smoke and squint her eyes.
She said, "You have to promise not to laugh." That did it. I started laughing again and couldn't stop. Then she started laughing too, because I was bent over double, standing there at the sink with this image in my mind of some old guy who looked like the Creeper. But I knew she couldn't read my mind, so she had to be laughing at me laughing. She was still young enough to be silly with me like a kid. Then she brought out two pictures, one of him and the other of his sister. She put them down side by side on the table. "Make sure your hands are dry." I took off my glasses and bent down to the man first so I could see up close as I stood there wiping my hands on the dishcloth. It was one of those studio pictures where somebody posed him in a three-quarter view. He had his unruly hair and eyebrows pasted down, and you could tell he was fresh out of the bath, and his white shirt was starched hard. He was holding his scrubbed face with effort toward where the photographer told him to look, which was too much into the direction of the best light. Beneath the forced smile, he was frowning with discomfort, and there was something else. It was something like defeat or simple tiredness in his pose, and you could see it best in the heavy lids of his large, blank eyes. He looked out of that face at the world with what remained of his self-confidence and trust in the world. His shaggy presence said that it was all worthwhile, and maybe even in some way he would not ever understand, also important. I understood all of that even then, but would never have been able to put my reading of him into words like these. Then I looked at the woman. She was an old hawk. Her skin was badly wrinkled, like the skin of ancient Indians I'd seen in the photographs and westerns. There was something like a smile coming out of her face, but it had come out sort of sideways and made her look silly. The main thing about her was that she looked very mean. On second thought, to give her the benefit of the doubt, I can say it might have just been plain hardness from having a hard life. She was wearing a black iron stiff dress buttoned up to her dickie, which was ironically dainty and tight around her goose neck. All I said, "They're so old." I don't know what else I thought as I looked up at my mother, who was leaning over my shoulder looking at the pictures too, as though she had never seen them before, as though she was trying to see them through my eyes. "You're just young, Tommy. Everybody's old to you. They're not so old. To me, he looks lonely." I looked again at him and thought I saw what she meant. I put the dishes away and she took the photographs back, and we didn't talk any more that night about Mitch and Temple. We watched our black and white television screen, which showed us Red Skelton acting silly for laughs, so we laughed at him. Before it was over, I fell asleep on the couch and my mother woke me when she turned off the television. "You should go to bed, Tommy." I stood up and stretched. "I have a science paper to write." "Well, get up early and write it," she said, putting out her cigarette. "He wants me to meet him someplace," my mother said. She had just finished talking with him and was standing by the telephone. It was close to dinner time. I'd been home from school since 3:30, and she'd been in from work by then for a good hour. She'd just hung up from the shortest conversation she'd ever had with him. I had wondered why they never wanted to meet. Then I stopped wondering and felt glad they hadn't. Now I was afraid. Afraid for her, for myself, and for the poor old man in the picture. Why did we have to go through with this crazy thing? "I told him I needed to talk to you about it first," she said. "I told him I'd call him back." I was standing there in front of her, looking at her. She was a scared little girl with wild eyes dancing in her head, unable to make up her own mind. I sensed her fear. I resented her for the mess she'd gotten herself in. I also resented her for needing my consent. I knew she wanted me to say go to him, meet him somewhere. I could tell. She was too curious not to want to go. I suddenly thought that he might be a millionaire and that she'd marry him and he might eventually die and leave her his fortune. But there was the sister. She was in the way, and from the looks of her, she would pass herself off as one of the living for at least another 100 years or so. So I gave up on that fantasy. "Well, why don't you tell him you'll meet him at the Hamburger Cafe on Wentworth? We can eat dinner there." "We? Sure. I'll just sit at the counter like I don't know you. But I gotta be there to protect you." "I see. And then you can walk in alone. I'll be already there, eating a cheeseburger and fries. He'll come in and see you waiting for him alone at a table."
"No, I'll sit at the counter too," she said.
"Okay, you sit at the counter too.
What time should I tell him?"
I looked at my Timex. It was 6. I knew they lived on the west side, and that meant it would take him at least an hour by bus and then half an hour by car. You probably didn't have a car. I was hungry, though, and had already set my mind on a cheeseburger rather than macaroni and cheese out of the box. Well, tell him 7:30. Okay. I went to my room. I didn't want to hear her talking to him in her soft, whispering voice. I had stopped listening in some time before. I looked at the notes for homework and felt sick in my stomach at the thought of having to write that late science paper. A few minutes later, my mother came in and said, "Okay, it's all set." She sat down on the side of my bed and folded her pale hands in her lap. "What should I wear?" "Wear your green dress and the brown shoes." "You like that dress, don't you?" "I like that one and the black one with the yellow at the top. It's classical." "You mean classy." "Whatever I mean." I felt really grown up that night. "Here, Tommy, take this." She handed me a $10 bill she'd been hiding in her right hand. "Don't spend it all. Buy your burger and fries and keep the rest just to have. If you spend it all in that hamburger place, I'm going to deduct it from your allowance." When I got there, I changed my mind about the counter. I took a table by myself. A cheeseburger, fries, and a Coke cost me $3. I was eating my cheeseburger and fries and watching the revolving door. The cafe was noisy with shouts, cackling, giggles, and verbal warfare. The waitress, Mrs. Ebo, was in a bad mood. She had set my hamburger plate down like it was burning her hand. I kept my eye on the door. Every time somebody came in, I looked up. Every time somebody left, I looked up. I finished my cheeseburger even before my mother got there, and ignoring her warning, I ordered another and another Coke to go with it. I figured I could eat two or three cheeseburgers and still have some money left over. Then my mother came in like a bright light into a dingy room. I think she must have been the most beautiful woman who ever entered that place, and it was her first time coming there. She had always been something of a snob and did not believe in places like this. I knew she had agreed to meet Mr. Kibbs here because she believed in my right to a cheeseburger, and this place had the best in the neighborhood. I watched her walk ladylike to the counter and ease herself up on the stool and sit there with her back arched. People in that place didn't walk or sit like that. She was acting classy, and everybody turned to look at her. I looked around at the faces, and a lot of women had these real mean, sneering looks like somebody had broke wind. She didn't know any of these people, and they didn't know her. Some of them may have known her by sight, and me too, but that was about all the contact we had with this part of the neighborhood. Besides, we hardly ever ate out, and when we did, we usually ate Chinese or at the rib place. I sipped my Coke and watched Mrs. Ebo place a cup of coffee before my mother on the counter. She was a coffee freak. She always was. All day long, long into the night, cigarettes and coffee in a continuous cycle. I grew up with her that way. The harsh smells are still in my memory. When she picked up the cup with a dainty finger sticking out just so, I heard a big fat woman at a table in front of mine say to the big fat woman at the table with her that my mother was a snooty bitch. The other woman said, "Yeah, she must think she white. What's she doing in here anyway?" Mr. Kibbs came in about 20 minutes after my mother, and I watched him stop and stand just inside the revolving doors. He stood to the side. He looked a lot younger than in the picture. He was stooped a bit, though, and he wasn't dressed like a millionaire, which disappointed me, but he was clean. He was wearing a necktie and a clean white shirt, and a suit that looked like it was about 200 years old, but one, no doubt, made of the best wool. Although it was fall, he looked overdressed for the season. He looked like a man who hadn't been out in the daylight in a long while. He was nervous, I could tell. Everybody was looking at him. Rarely did white people come in here. Then he went to my mother like he knew she had to be the person he had come in to see. He sat himself up on the stool beside her and leaned forward with his elbows on the counter and looked in her face. She looked back in that timid way of hers, but she wasn't timid. It was an act and part of her ladylike posture. She used it when she needed it. He ordered something to eat, and my mother ordered too. I don't remember what. They talked and talked, and I sat there eating and protecting her till I spent the whole $10. Even as I ran out of money, I knew she would forgive me. She had always forgiven me on special occasions, and this was a special occasion for sure. She never told me what they talked about in the cafe, and I never asked. But everything that happened after that meeting went toward the finishing off of the affair my mother was having with Mitch Kibbs. He called her later that night. I was in my room, working on that dumb science paper when the phone rang, and I could hear her speaking to him in that ladylike way. It was not the way she talked to me. I was different. She didn't need to impress me. I was her son. But I couldn't hear what she was saying and didn't want to. Mr. Kibbs called the next evening, too, but eventually the calls were fewer and fewer till he no longer called. My mother and I went on living as we had before he called the wrong number, and after a while, we never talked about him or his sister again. That story was called My Mother and Mitch by the great African-American writer who isn't, you know, anyways. He's 85. He teaches, or he was teaching somewhere in Southern California, but I guess he's retired now. And my buddy, story prior to that, my old school buddy, not my buddy now, I don't like him anymore. I beat him up. No, I'm just kidding. School ended. Everybody dispersed to the winds. He also was teaching. I think he's still teaching in Southern California. He was a funny guy, and that was a funny story. The Fix by Percival Everett. Last week I was screwed up. I failed to reconfigure the software properly that would allow me to broadcast this show. So last week's archived show is not archived. I was just reading to my computer and nobody was knowing it but me and my computer. If you're into that kind of conspiracy of computers listening in. Anyways, but I'm going to get it together and re-record three stories that I read last week. One by N.K. Jemisin, one by Barbara Neely, and one by the inimitable Chester Himes. Several of his books have been turned into movies, and N.K. Jemisin's trilogy, three-time Hugo Award winner, that's the science fiction award,